You're very welcome back to the second hour of the 9 till noon show. Good morning, if you're just after joining us. It was an interesting hour's conversation, no doubt. Lots of you texting in, greatly appreciated, of course. That fella says we don't care about people in Asia or Africa. What about the local people whose houses are falling apart on top of them over the last 10 years? What has he, anyone else, not affected by this done for them? Maynooth University did research recently about the climate a day or two ago. It was big news. Maynooth University's biggest donor is Bill Gates, Microsoft to the tune of $300K. Funny, isn't it? Bill always got his hands in the climate agenda. Hey, Greg, I don't think people here are not concerned about climate change. It's just that we feel all the laws and hardships and costs being forced on us is for no benefit. When you look around the world and you see the wars going on and see large countries like America, China, India doing what they like and Australia opening coal pits, we feel that whatever we do does not matter one iota on the grand scheme of world climate change, which is an accepted reality. That is part of the problem, no doubt about that. Hi, Greg. During COVID, no planes in the air and the hole in the ozone closed. That's how much plane jet engines affect our climate. Why is there not a call to find an alternative to the jet engine? Well, there is actually ongoing research, and I seem to recall reading that there's one of the main manufacturers that are ready to start testing a plane which would have electric engines effectively and would cover an awful lot of short-haul type flights. Is the climate change not just the cycle of the world, says a listener? It may well be. The scientists say that the change, since the industrialization of this planet, since that period, has changed more rapidly than you might ordinarily expect. But even if that is the case, do we not have sort of an onus to try and slow down nature if we can, if you believe that's the case or not? If skin cancer is the most prolific cancer in Ireland, as you state, obviously according to data, then could it be argued that the lack of sunshine in Ireland could be the cause of skin cancer? Well, the argument being I don't know the ins and outs of it. I'm not a scientist, nor am I given medical advice. But as I said yesterday, depending on the prevailing climate, your skin will be fairer or darker. You go from the north to the south, you can see that. We are not conditioned to be exposed to sunlight for long periods of time. That's what makes us more prone to cancer, skin cancer, it seems. Ask him how healthy is salmon you buy in any shop in comparison to the meat he says is unhealthy. I'm sitting here with 12 degree temperatures and freezing. We had the coldest June in a decade. Global warming seems a very unfortunate term for Donegal. Today we're 21 degrees and where temperatures are supposed to reach in Ireland. Well, it's climate change, global warming is a bit of a misnomer. The fact that you're sitting in 12 degrees temperatures on a windy, wet July, and I'm not saying this, is actually how global warming or climate change is affecting you, is what they might say. Don't forget I'm not going to argue with it. I'm just putting out different texts that are coming in. Hi, Greg. I think our climate here in Ireland has been reduced to a hybrid of spring combined with autumn, meaning we will not really get the highs of summer nor the lows of winter. It feels like that, doesn't it? Was on Ballymastocker Beach on Tuesday for a beautiful walk and witnessed the coastal erosion there due to high tides from climate change, believes a listener. I just think we're a tiny island, says another, that will contribute a very small percentage to global emissions. The biggest contributors will be the poorer countries like India, who've massive emissions, but those countries are too poor to expect their people to change their lifestyle. I get exactly what you're talking about. I'm just putting out counterpoints to all of the texts, whether they're for or against. It's just for the purpose of conversation and to promote engagement. But per head of population, we would be well up there compared to the likes of China, India and the US. Obviously, when you take the greater population, you know, there's 360 million in America. There's 7-8 million on the island of Ireland. Of course, the emissions over there are going to be greater than here. But if you break it down per head of population, things change a little bit. Irish people don't give a hoot about anything, believes a texter. Okay, thanks very much indeed. Ireland's getting colder instead of warmer, colder and wetter. Yeah, that's true. And that sounds to me like you're, you know, accepting that that's how it might impact us. I don't know. Climate change, there's the weather and climate change are two sort of separate things. England experienced 40 degree heat last year. It was near an army base, so that's why it's so hot. Another, the floods in Dubai were caused by cloud seeding. This is happening in America too. Politicians preach to us about flights and emissions, yet they use private jets and helicopters. You have to lead by example, believes a listener. Back to the roads. John's correct about the Lifford-Letterkenny Road around them trees. In the last number of years, there've been a number of fatalities in that stretch alone. I'm from that area. They're putting up crash barriers where they're not needed. Non-Tolly Wrap convoy to Rafoe, a death trap waiting to happen. Another, the back roads are not fit for the size of the HGVs now, and the lorry drivers' working hours are too long. But if you look at the instances of cases involving professional drivers versus non-professional drivers, and then you consider how many collisions they're involved in, as I was saying, it's quite low. The guards never off the road in Donegal Town. Are the tax collectors for the government? Tell John they are widening that part of the road at the trees. Greg, yourself and John are so correct about no guard or patrol car present for checkpoints on our roads. In over 55 years, I've travelled the length and breadth of Ireland, north and south, 30 counties in total. I could count on one hand the number of checkpoints I encountered in the last 20 of those years. Checkpoints used to be much more prevalent prior to this. And that's just a sample of the many, many comments that are coming in on the programme this morning. And if yours hasn't been read yet, it will be. Now, as part of Your Voice, Your Community, in association with Commissioner Mann, funded by the TV licence, we speak to Reverend John Atto from Nigeria, who is stationed on beautiful Aranmore Island, and he's in studio with me now. Father, good morning to you.
Thank you. Good morning.
How are you keeping?
I'm great, and thanks for inviting me as well.
No, it's our pleasure. We're delighted to have you on the programme. Right. Okay. Talk to me a little bit about your early life, if that's okay, and what life is like for you in Nigeria.
Okay. Once again, thanks very much. My early life, I was born in Nigeria.
Mm-hmm.
I studied in Nigeria, ordained in Nigeria, and I came over here some few years to do my postgraduate studies, and here on the great country of Ireland. My early life, I had my primary school and secondary school in Kafranchan, and also as an altar server, I came across many great sons and daughters of Ireland who came over on mission. And they were a great influence, and they supported my little study, and put it this way.
Mm-hmm.
And their lifestyle was quite encouraging, and they talked to some of us coming up becoming a priest. And as altar server, we said, okay, we'll give it a try after my secondary school. So I applied to the diocese, and I was offered to study for the diocese of Jos then in Nigeria, before Kafanchan was carved out of Jos diocese, now Jos archdiocese. So after my seminary formation, I was ordained in 2002, and I worked in various places in the diocese, and as school formator and also as parish priest. Then I was offered the privilege to come over to study here, and I did my postgraduate studies in Maynooth. I studied, first of all, sacred liturgy, and then after that I did biblical studies again with the Dominicans in Dublin. And from there then I came across great priests, one of the great priests here in Rafoe. Father Dennis Quinn, who is now in Carrick, but then he was in Falkara. He came to Maynooth. I remember he was looking for somebody to do cover for him, and I was lucky that I came over. And since then, I have been part of the diocese in and out during my studies. So when I was done then, I told him, okay, I'm done, but I would like to talk with Bishop Allen, and that if there's need for me to give my little help, put it this way. The Irish voice was calling me. I never knew that. I said, okay, if possible, let me give some time to support the work here in the diocese.
You said the Irish people were calling you. Was there a spiritual calling as well?
Oh, no, because I think definitely I felt that the priests were getting short and they needed help. And I just offered myself that way.
Your life here in Ireland is very different to that in Nigeria on many levels, but even when we boil it down to becoming a priest because a friend of yours, a close friend of yours, Father Gabriel, from the same area that you're from in Nigeria, he was kidnapped, and this is part of a story of traumatic things in that area that happens to both priests and sort of the wider population. What happened to Father Gabriel?
Oh, well, he was the last, for example, this way, quote unquote, to be kidnapped of recent. For the past 2 years, 10 of my brother priests were kidnapped in the diocese of Kafanchan. Mm. 10. And they were picked up from the parochial house. And unfortunately, one of them was killed. And his body was found almost 10 days later. And he was almost decomposed. So they had to pick him and hurried him to be buried. Like for Father Gabriel Uke, because we grew up from the same area and the same parish, and we grew up together knowing each other. His honor was just quite surprising. I remember I spoke with him a few days before he was picked up from the house. Mm-hmm. And he was in high spirit and telling me that the bishop was to come to a visit in the parish. So he was telling me that it was just late at night and they came, surrounded the house, well-armed, and they came with the house help. They have access to the first door, but to the bedroom they couldn't, and they have to use their gun to fire the key and to open up the door. There they picked him up, and he's still going through, and they took him to a long distance whereby he was there for days, and the diocese have to find a means of bringing him out from their den.
Yeah.
And but actually with that, definitely with those fellows, a huge amount of money have to be paid in as a ransom, and they give deadline, and these guys, you can't take them for a ride, and if they say we need the money by tomorrow 12 p.m., if that money is not there, definitely the person will have to, they have to waste the person. And sometimes, unfortunately, again, you can pay the ransom and definitely, again, they'll still waste the fellow.
But also, too, I presume they are ruthless in that they will prove what may happen if the ransom is not paid.
Yeah. Yeah, because what they do, first of all, I think from the beginning, it's not just about picking up the priests or the clergy. I think from the beginning, even up to this point in time, they are, I'll just put it this way, a kind of land grabbing of a thing and trying to eliminate the Christian areas. Mm. And because my diocese have a very huge population of Christians and they have good arable lands, and because they're very poor and they have to go to their farms and everything. So these guys, they'll come up, and next they do is they overrun the place, kill everybody at sight, and destroy, burn whatever they can burn at sight.
Yeah.
So, in the end,
it's horrendous.
Yeah.
And who's responsible? Who is behind these kidnappings? Is it, is it a group of individuals? Is it an organized sort of...
Actually, the government knows who are these people, and the whole world knows, and they are called the Fulanis. I think they were rated as the third most dangerous terrorist group in the world. And definitely this Fulani, they are a kind of a tribe that they live within 14 African countries. And because in Africa, we have what we call the ECOWAS Treaty that allows free movement of people within the region in and out. And definitely the government knows, but you see, sometimes when the government is not maybe proactive, and that's what happens. Or maybe they try to be politically correct, or they look the other way, that's what happens. And this has started as far back as over 10 years or 20 years, put it this way. Besides, it became so alarming in 2014. And I can just tell you, I remember the governor, I think he was quoted in one of these dailies as saying, to be precise, one of the local papers there in Nigeria, Daily Post, on the 3rd of December 2016, he was quoted saying that he traced those guys to the neighboring country and had paid to them huge amount of money to stop killing the people within my diocese. Mm. But the question that remains unanswered is, what is the crime of the people of Kafanchan Diocese that are being attacked day in, day out, and they are left in traumatic situation? What is their crime? That's what the question that has remained unanswered. And sometimes when the government speak, they speak normally. When something happens, they just give a statement. Like my brother, the last person who was kidnapped, and they just put up the news that they are saddened, this and that. And that's all. They just make comments and there's no follow-up.
What more could be done, though? You know, because they would say, well, we're trying our best behind the scenes or this, that and that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, is it obvious where the gap is? What could the Nigerian government be doing more, in your view, Father?
Now, you see, the government, they have no political will to do that, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
And everything about it seems to be politics. And everybody wants to save his own territory.
Mm-hmm.
But if the government are really serious, they know where these guys are. They have all the intelligence. And if this fellow who was a governor and able to say something like this, then they can ask him that, can you tell us more? We trace where they are and who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're able to save the situation. And if those people who have come, conquered and occupied spaces, and they're being flushed out because the Nigerian army, they are capable of doing that. What is still lacking, as I said, is the political will of the government.
Is there a particular problem in northern Nigeria, in Kasantau, where you're from, or are we speaking about that area because that is where your knowledge base is and that is where you're from? Like, what is life like in Nigeria for the general population across the whole country, the massive country?
Sorry to say this, and generally, the life is already just within. Nobody feels secured in Nigeria at the moment, and definitely Nigerians, they're hardworking people, and everybody wants to work hard to earn some to make a living for himself. And with this, there's huge danger coming or looming in there, maybe somewhere at the corner. That there will be not hunger, but there will be starvation from this year.
Mm-hmm.
Because farmers can't go to farm. There's insecurity. Nobody is sure. Everybody is traumatized. And the food shortage will definitely bring everybody to his knee.
Just one final word on your brother, Father Gabriel. How is he now?
The last I spoke with him, he's still complaining that the few days he was with them, it wasn't easy.
Is it more the emotional?
Yeah, both emotional element? And also physically and also psychologically traumatized.
Mm.
And he was complaining that up to now he's still receiving treatment.
Yeah, counseling.
Yeah.
In that way. And physical.
Yeah.
And physical. What, and we all are thinking on Father Gabriel, and we'll include him in our prayers for his recovery, of course. So what age were you when you actually joined the priesthood, Father?
Say that again.
What age were you when you were called to the priesthood?
Oh, I went in as immediately I finished up my secondary school, and about 18. So, and from there I finished up on time.
But what drew you at that age? What made you think that this life could be for you? Because it is a life of sacrifice and giving, you know.
Yes, it's a life of sacrifice. And it was built around the faith my father handed on to me. And up to today, I still remember where we sat with my dad at Mass, and he challenged me and my brothers and sisters that we are together, and that we need to do something about it, not just coming to Mass, we have to go to make communion. And my father was a kind of a strict fellow. And definitely he said to me, I remember he said to us, look, if you don't go for catechism class to be instructed for a year for your first communion, no meal for you. So any day we fail to go for catechism instruction at the parish house, that day there's no meal. So we have to go in.
And
you
stuck to his word.
Oh, for sure. And I think Devin, he was so happy that we made our first communion ourselves. And so after that, then I told my twin brother, after the first communion, I said, I'll join the altar servers, because they were just my age group at that time. I was just still very young in primary school. So then I started coming up to the church, get myself introduced to the priest, and I was interviewed, and I was offered the opportunity to be part of the team. And after about 6 months of training, I started serving. And I remembered the very first day my dad saw me. And because on this ground, I never told my dad that I was going to be part of the altar server. I just went in. And I remember every weekend he never set his eyes on me at home. And in the morning, when I went for morning mass, I never returned home till in the evening. And he was wondering, where is this fellow hanging around?
You're up to no good.
Yeah. But the day I was to serve, it was in a big church. And he was surprised, and then he couldn't just believe. I think he was lost throughout the mass.
Mm.
Oh, my son is up here. So from there, I started maybe. So the priest, I remember very much, good Irish priest who really showed us love and said, okay, we can begin now. From there, I started moving up each by each.
And you have a choice, presumably, where you can do your studies. Is it that connection with that priest that drew you to Ireland?
After my secondary school, I had a choice, and because I was lucky, and I got, after my national exams, I had the qualification to go to university. And actually, to be very frank, seminary was probably another alternative, put it plan B. And so I was to study geography and regional town planning in the university in Nigeria, and I applied for that, and I was waiting for admission. Then one of the priests spoke to me and said, why can't you try seminary? You look good, you can be a good priest. I said, okay. Then I put on the application. Then he sent me, and then he put a recommendation letter for me. And from there, I was privileged. Out of many who were invited for the interview, I remember that there were about 200, but I was among the lucky 16 to be taken.
Mm.
So from there, my journey began.
And presumably too, and I'm jumping forward a little bit, in coming here, the bishop here would have to engage with the bishop in Nigeria.
Yeah.
I wonder how that conversation went.
Yes, because I was here for studies, and I used to come to do relief for my priest father, Dennis Queen. And so from there, I get to know some other priests around. And so when I was done with my studies, and I said, okay, this is what I'm thinking. And Queen spoke with Bishop Allen, and Bishop Allen said, okay, I should come over to have a chat with him. And then I did. We had a good chat and had that communication at their own levels. Then from there, he offered me letters. Then I have to go home for sure for a while and to make my process again to come back here. So they had the discussion at their own level. What is very important to me wasn't what they discussed, but the permission to be here.
Yes, okay. We're not going to get the details, okay. So what is life like for you here? Because obviously it might be easy to say it's a completely different world. Obviously, you know, in terms of climate, in terms of people, in terms of your family connections and all that type of stuff. But then again, it depends on how you look at this world and what is home. Is it where you feel at home? Is it the people around you? We're all kind of very much the same as humans, if you know what I mean. You can form new connections elsewhere. But for you, do you feel at home now? And I suppose if you do, and I suspect that you do, what makes home for you?
Yeah, what makes home for me is the acceptance of who we are, who you are in a particular area. That makes you home. So you don't bring your maybe relations with you, but the people you meet on ground are your family and they remain your home. First of all, I'm very, very grateful. I'm not saying because I'm here. I'm very, very grateful to the priests of this diocese of Rafa.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, they're just too good. When I arrived, and I was asked, I was given a place. everybody, even to this very moment, every priest is eager to help. Yes. He's interested in my happiness. Everybody. And you can imagine somebody traveling distances to come over to Bottom Port to pick me out. And they will give me a ring. Oh, are you bored? Can you come out? You know? And everybody's, you know, I'm not complaining. So whom is the acceptance of where you are?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's and, a learn from that little.
Yeah, and also the people on the island. Oh, they're just too good.
It's a very unique place, Aranmore Island. I love it. It's one of my top, you know, three or four places in the country, the whole country. I absolutely love it over there. It is.
Yeah.
It's beautiful, isn't it? And the people are amazing too.
Yeah. No, actually, the whole thing is this. As I said earlier, whom is the welcoming you are offered when you arrive at a place? And the very day I stepped my feet on that island, everybody. I mean everybody. And even on the altar, if I make an appeal, please can we come together to do something at your only job, everybody comes and sneaks in to do one or two things.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I'll be surprised, I'll come out of the house, I'll find some work has been carried out without knowing myself doing the person. I'll start asking who came over during this then.
Yes,
you know? So you see, the whole thing is...
They look after you.
Yeah, they look after me. And the people have been so wonderfully great. Yeah.
It's one of the challenges whereby, you know, I mean, obviously you've made great sacrifices and will make great sacrifices in your life as a priest.
Yeah.
But obviously, you know, you are still very much from Kasan Chow in your heart and your family. So your fellow priests over there that continue to face the danger of kidnap and what have you, is that tough for you over here, you know, and thankfully, you know, safe and secure and well looked after for, but know that those that... you know, you have great love and care for, are doing, you know, similar work in a different place, but in great danger.
Yeah, actually mine here is a privilege to be here. And also every day, my mind goes home.
Mm.
I have to speak with everybody in the morning, at noon, and late at night.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when I wake up, I see messages on my phone, I get frightened. What is up again, you know? So sometimes being here doesn't mean that I have full peace.
You know what I mean? Yeah.
So, but the whole thing is I'm here on mission. As the scripture says, once the hand is set on the plow, he who looks back is not fit for the journey.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have to look out from what I'm here for, to give my little bit and to support the church mission here in the Diocese of Rafal.
And we've seen this, you know, from local parish priests right up to the bishop.
Yeah.
You never know when your time in a particular area might come to an end. And part of signing up to an area is that you, if the bishop says something or those who are acting as bishop, that has to be followed. So do you allow yourself to get as attached to Aranmore Island as you might want to? Because obviously you also, to some extent perhaps, have to prepare for an inevitable move at some point. I presume you hope it's not for some time, but I do remember speaking to Bishop McGuckian just prior to his departure, and he always held a little something back. I'm paraphrasing him. He always held a little something back wherever he went. But because in the stage of his career, I think he allowed himself to plant deep roots in Rafal, which were harder to pull as he moved to his new calling, new following. How do you deal with that side of this job?
No. Actually, the priest in his formation is being trained to be open-minded.
Mm-hmm.
And open-minded in the sense that you are ready to walk anywhere the church wants you to be, or God wants you through the mother church to be. And the danger is when you begin to have a kind of a mindset, I want to be in this place, then you're beginning to develop crisis for yourself.
Yes.
But when you're open-minded, then you have nothing to worry.
Mm-hmm.
And you never get attached to any place. And anywhere you've been assigned to be, you blossom within the space you're asked to be there.
Yes.
You blossom and you go. And that's... So to me, I told Bishop Alan then, I said, look, I'm here in this diocese with an open mind, and I came up to Ireland. and with no mindset than to do God's work and to support the mission of the church. So if they ask me to stay there as long, fine. I'm happy with it. If they ask me to move tomorrow, good. I'm happy with it. Okay. Yeah.
And finally, oh, not finally, because it sounds like a negative thing to finish on, but I don't think it's a negative question.
Yeah.
What do you see as the greatest challenge as a priest?
Oh. Well, the greatest challenge as a priest is for you to look at, you will begin to look for happiness outside yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It's another one.
How are you getting on with that?
That means nobody gives you joy. You yourself, you have to want to appreciate who you are and mm-hmm. what you are and make yourself happy and blossom within you where you are. And it's one of the challenges that every priest have to look at and develop that. But when you begin to look outside that people must make you happy, then definitely you begin to have crisis.
Very good.
And again, another challenge is sometimes if you think everybody will like you, not everyone will like you at all. Yeah.
Well, that's not unique to being a priest, I can tell you that.
Yeah. So definitely, but in an area whereby you have up to 99% are with you, good to go. Everybody likes you there.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Well, it's been lovely speaking to you, Father John Atto. Is there anything else you want to add yourself or anything that you wish to say?
Yes. First of all, I would like to appreciate the Diocese of Rafo and for offering me the opportunity to come and work with them and to pay back what I tell people, pay back to the Irish Church their sacrifices that their sons and daughters made many years ago back in Nigeria. They came over when Nigeria had no priest. And now here we are again, trying to support the mission. I'm very grateful to that. And also I want to thank again the priests of the Diocese of Rafo. I can't just thank them enough, and because they definitely the welcome and the love I have received since Bishop Allan was here, and even he left, and with the administrator Kevin, Monsignor Kevin, and Michael, and everybody. So I'm so happy to be here. But one thing is this: I want to just try to appeal to the Catholics here. Don't forget my diocese back home. We are going through hell, put it this way, through hell. Pray for my bishop, pray for my brother priest, and pray for the Catholics and the Christians there that their faith will never go down, and despite what they go through. And we look forward to seeing if they have any means of trying to keep us in their special prayers. I think I would really appreciate that.
Father John, can I say we really appreciate you? I really appreciate you coming over and having a conversation with us. It's been very enjoyable, and it's been very interesting, and very sad and concerning to hear of what some are having to, or many are having to endure in Nigeria. And at your request, those inclined to pray, I'm sure will include your bishop and your fellow priests and the general population of Nigeria in their prayers. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. It's been lovely.
Thank you very much.
May God bless that priest, Father John. I have a friend who is a priest in Nigeria too. His name is Father Paul. He comes to Carn Donna often and says Mass at times when he comes to visit. Another lovely interview with the priest, a breath of fresh air. Greg asked good questions. Well, thank you very much for that. So I received a letter, and this is a kind of an area of and a number of emails as well, by the way, but I'm just going to reference the letter. It's not an area I'm terribly comfortable in covering, but I think it's important to at the same time. Greg, before the recent council elections, Declan Meehan declared he was an affected homeowner in the defective concrete block crisis. Now he's selling his house. And it mentions the price, which is not relevant to this conversation. Is this, well, it's full price, you know, effectively. Is this not a defective concrete house? Has he more than one house? Did he lie? There's probably a simple explanation, but I think it should be checked out. And there is a relatively simple explanation. Councillor Declan Meehan, Independent, joins us now. Hi, Declan.
Good morning, Greg.
As I say, this is your private life, if you know what I mean, and it's not an area I'm particularly keen to sort of stick my nose in. But that being said, I suppose, you know, you've thought about this and you thought, right, well, if people are putting this about, we might as well get it out into the open. So when you first suspected you had defective concrete in your house. This is what you were referencing. I presume you were pretty much in your mind convinced. You know yourself, a lot of us buried our head in the sands, pretended it wasn't. You were sort of the opposite almost in that you saw the signs and you said, well, I'm not going to be one of those. This has all the hallmarks of defective concrete.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I suppose we bought our house in 2018. At that point, we had a surveyor out as part of the normal purchasing process who didn't suspect any sort of defective blocks or mica, as it was called back then, at that point. To be honest, there wasn't a huge amount of awareness, particularly amongst ourselves, when we bought the house around the issue. And it was only when the campaign started reigniting in 2021 that we started to look at the house and go, I wonder, are we affected? When we were purchasing our house, before we bought it, the bank that was selling the house had actually done a test, a core test on the house. And in July 2021, we tracked down the engineer who had carried out that test. And they had kind of gone off the record, but had sent us a text to say that, and the quote was, the test wasn't carried out to IS465 standard, but it indicated high levels of total mica, and it would definitely not be clear of mica if it was tested further. So that was our first kind of, you know, confirmation for us, our worst sort of nightmare realised in relation to our own home. Fast forward a few months then to November of the same year, and we had one of the best known engineers in this area in the county to come down and do a visual inspection of the house. And his assessment on that day was exactly the same. He said, you know, you won't know until you actually do a test. But I would say that this house is basically riddled with mica, were his words, and that the house would have to be demolished in time.
All right, so if I could just hold you there on that, just to be clear, and I'm not here working on your behalf, but it's actually relevant to other people out there listening as well who are in the same boat, and this resonates with me a little bit. In terms of your two points of information at this point was the off-the-record commentary was effectively saying you have defective concrete, prepare yourself for that. But B, the visual inspection that is required to actually get you on the scheme, and obviously it triggers a core test and all of that, but these guys see an awful lot of houses. On a visual inspection, he effectively said that your house is riddled with defective concrete and would require most likely demolition.
Exactly, yeah. And I mean, look, I suppose that's the basis on which a lot of people operate when they say that they're affected homeowners, is that it's advice from an engineer or another qualified contractor or professional on that basis, or even people who have gone through the scheme and who are affected, who know the signs themselves, neighbours, friends, colleagues, whatever. And that was the same with ourselves. But I suppose we kind of sat on it from 2021. As far as we were concerned, that was our situation, was that we were affected by it. So much so that we joined the Coleman Legal class action case as well at that point. And obviously we were very involved in the various protests and campaigns with the Mica Action Group and 100% Redress. And then we kind of came to this year and we had seen a house that we wanted to purchase. And we had always kind of hemmed and hawed about the scheme for ourselves. Like everyone, we know that the scheme is not fit for purpose. It certainly wasn't fit for our particular set of circumstances with our home either. So we had made the decision that we wanted to sell the house to cut our losses, to sell it for a reduced price and to move on, but with full disclosure that it had defective blocks. And that was the recommendation from our engineer, who was the same person from November 2021, and also our estate agent. And of course, we'd never have dreamed of selling the house in any other context to pass anything on that unbeknownst to people. So we actually had the same engineer out to do the core test in April of this year. And we had the house lined up to go on the market because we were waiting on the test results to come back so that it could be sold with the test already having taken place. So the test was a full suite, mica, pyrite, and block strength. And that came back to us 2 weeks ago on Tuesday while we were actually on holidays. And it came back where it was actually clear of deleterious materials under all of those headings and strong compression strength for the blocks. So I have to say, like, our first reaction to that obviously was complete shock and disbelief. And that's the situation that we're in now. You know, there's,
but it's good news, though. I mean, you're a couple of a very small cohort of people that have accepted their house is worthless or well worth, you know, market value, effectively the site and what have you, and you've got the good news that actually it's not the case. So, I mean, I presume shock and awe. You're allowed to feel joy too, Declan. I mean, I would say.
Yeah, look, the joy hasn't actually set in yet. I'm just going to be honest. I suppose it is genuinely shock and disbelief that has been there. And then my concern, obviously, has been over the past week or two that exactly what your letter has stated, where people would wonder, well, was he jumping on a bandwagon? Was he trying to make political capital out of a miserable situation for others? And it has absolutely not been the case. This has been mine and my husband's lived reality for the past 3 years. And I suppose what I want to take the opportunity today, Greg, and I thank you for the opportunity to come on to provide clarity and transparency on this, but also to reaffirm my commitment to affected homeowners across the Milford electoral area and across the county more generally, that this is still a huge priority and number one priority for me for my 5-year term that's ahead of me on Donegal County Council. Mm. You know, since I've become a councillor, I have been working with and making representations on behalf of families and individuals going through the scheme, trying to get ancillary grants, all of the usual stuff. So though my circumstances have changed due to a real stroke of luck, and that is all it is, my priorities for the coming term absolutely have not changed.
Okay, I'm fascinated to ask, what is the cause, what was the cause of, you know, what appeared to be the problem? Was it bad plaster or, we only got about a minute, but...
It's two different things. Bad plaster on one of the gable walls, which had presented as kind of honeycomb cracking, so they reckon that that's not bad plaster. And the other thing was our house is built up on a height on raised land, and they reckon that it's just simply settlement cracks from that.
Okay.
Look, as I say, an extreme stroke of luck for us, but it does not change my priorities and how I'll represent people in the Milford electoral area over the coming 5 years.
All right, well, that's that clarified. Okay, listen, Councillor Meehan, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
All right, that is Councillor Declan Meehan explaining the situation there. And I suppose, actually, you know, I went into that thinking it was a bit personal, but actually, as Declan discussed it and the fact that it did form part of early campaigns, actually it is very much in the public interest to get that information clarified there.